This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of the show today, we hear from Tim Sparks and James Buckley. The talented musicians are out with a new album, Jukebox Dreaming, and that means there's a new tour, including a stop in Moorhead, Minnesota. But first, as the state's new legislative session is officially in its first full week of duties, we revisit a conversation about how government and journalists are supposed to work. This past April, there was a Good Government Summit supported by ThinkND, the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, Humanities North Dakota, and the Bush Foundation. The media panel included Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, Cecile Werman with Journal Publishing, which publishes papers in Crosby and Tioga, Amy Dalrymple with the Bismarck Tribune, Jack Zaleski with the Forum, and Mike Jacobs with the Grand Forks Herald. Doug Hamilton moderated the discussion.
What has changed about government in North Dakota since you started, Cecile?
Well, I would have started my reporting career in Williston in 1985, and the thing that I always appreciated but didn't realize how special it really was from the get-go was how accessible all of our state officials are. I would like to say that they're all as accessible as they were back then. They aren't quite. But just a brief story about how to illustrate that is Governor Sinner was the governor at the time, and he was so personable to a young reporter who was probably asking pretty dumb questions at that time, but he remembered me as my career went from Williston to Grand Forks, and at the time that I was looking at leaving North Dakota for a time, he offered to write me a letter of recommendation. And when I went to a news station in Kansas a few years later and presented this letter of recommendation from Governor Sinner, they were floored, absolutely floored. And I guess that's just an indication of how open North Dakota state officials are.
And what a spectacular fellow he was. Dave?
One of the biggest changes I've seen since I've covered politics, which I've been covering politics since the Dead Sea just become sick, was the fact that House members in the North Dakota legislature went from two-year to four-year terms. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge change, and it changed a lot of dynamics.
Jack?
I, too, have been covering North Dakota politics a long time. Mike and I were advisors to Gutenberg.
Martin Luther thanks you.
My story goes to Governor Arthur Link, who I found to be one of the greatest gentlemen and lovers of North Dakota that I have ever had the privilege to meet. He was at the Devil's Lake Journal at the time. Well, my editor had assigned me a story in which I needed to get comments from the governor. And I said, well, how do I do that? And my editor was a fellow named Russell Dushinsky, who you might know, some of you might have known. He said, well, call him. So I did. I called him at the old, which wasn't old then, but the governor's house, and Grace Link answered the phone. I could hear her say, hey, Art, it's Jack from Devil's Lake. And I'd met him a couple of times, and he was so astute, he remembered that my wife was from a ranching family in western North Dakota. I'd met him just a couple of times at various events. He comes to the phone, we do our business, I get a couple of quotes, hang up and go to write my story. Years later, and now, today, I think about that and how remarkable it seemed to be at the time, and it was. Most states weren't like that. And how remarkable it is in light of the changes that we see now. Try to call the governor today.
Mike.
Well, I'm so pleased to be invited because it's an opportunity for me to rib Jack a little bit. Art Link called me. And here's how it happened. It was very early in the new year of 1975, I think, and the phone rang at about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. It was New Year's Day. I'd been in bed for a few minutes. I probably wasn't really coherent, but the governor said to me, Jim, He always called me Jim. He never remembered my name in all of the years that we spent together. He said, you were asking me a question this afternoon, and I thought I should call you and give you a little more information. And I thought, this is North Dakota. And it's Art Link, because he would naturally think that everybody had been in bed since 9 p.m. I will say just a couple of things very briefly. It's fine to celebrate sunshine in North Dakota, but let me tell you, the clouds are moving in. The last legislature did some serious damage to open meetings laws. The one that's most significant to me is that it passed a law saying that no application records, no job, no application for any job would be public until it was down to 3 finalists. So that means if you're hiring a janitor at the Halliday School District, you're not going to know who the applicants are until the 3 fellows at the corner of the bar downtown who applied are finally revealed. The other, there is going on now a fairly serious effort to cut back on publication of public records in North Dakota, on the grounds that it can be done more easily online, and it will save money. You always want to go back to legislative intent. The constitutional originalists talk about what was the intent of the founders. The intent of the people who passed these publication laws was to make it easy for people to get a hold of information. You don't make it easy by cutting back on the number of places put information. You put it in as many places as you can. And that ought to include the newspapers. And finally, I will say that I have known Doug Burgum for a very long time, and I have a fair amount of affection and respect for him. But he is, without question, the least accessible governor of North Dakota that I've worked with. And I know all of them since John Davis.
Amy.
Well, I've been reporting on government for about 15 years in North Dakota. And there's only one meeting that I've ever been kicked out of. And it was actually on the Minnesota side of the river. I was at a search committee meeting for a president. And I went to it just assuming it was open because the NDSU version of that would have been open. And someone comes up to me and asks who I was and asks me to leave. And so I think it's a good thing, I guess, for North Dakota that that's never happened to me in North Dakota. But today, because of the law that Mike was just talking about, I would be asked to leave that same meeting on the North Dakota side of the river. So I do think, there has been a little bit of a tightening of access to government, but we still enjoy, I think, more access and more openness in North Dakota.
And I see the biggest change on the local level as far as accessibility. The local elected officials at the county, city, and school board level appear less aware these days about what their responsibilities are in regard to opening meetings and giving proper notice. Our newspaper, both in Crosby and Tioga, on many occasions in the almost 20 years that I've been there, have had to ask for attorney general's opinions, and we usually are upheld that we're viewing it correctly and that they aren't. Some of it is just a lack of knowledge, but some of it isn't. And I see more and more public officials these days on the local level who don't feel a particular duty to speak to the public or to speak to the press who is advocating on the public's
behalf.
They
can use their Facebook page or some other way of doing it. We've got all these different ways of getting information, and some of these are echo chambers, unfortunately.
And so it's frustrating that, we're actually there to help and assist them get their message out. I think in the fake news era that we are in, the sometimes disparaging comments that are made about the national press impacts how people react to journalists today. And it's just very sad because we're there to help and advocate for them, and they don't necessarily see us that way.
I think there's a misperception sometimes about what it is a journalist is and the fact that there are ethical guidelines for the proper practice of this profession. That isn't to say that these guidelines aren't occasionally abrogated, but that there are really rules of the road for the people who do this. Jack, you've made many requests for information for the forum to the state.
Foreign communications overall, because it has the resources, has fought this fight a lot, put a lot of money into it, and it gets expensive when you do that. Mostly successful, not always. Part of, I think, of what the problem is with the transparency of government, with the ability of the average citizen to know what's going on in government, is that the resources of the media, not only in North Dakota but in other places, but in North Dakota is what we know, those resources have been significantly reduced.
Yes.
There are fewer of us doing what we used to do in newsrooms like the Heralds and the Tribunes and ours in Fargo at the Forum were much larger. In the meantime, the state's grown. Our communities in most places in the state have grown. There's much more going on. We do not have the horses to do the job we used to do. When I think of, and Dave could speak to this better than I, when I think of the size of the Capitol Press Corps out here in Bismarck just about 10, 15, 20 years ago compared to what it is now, and the experience that was part of that press corps, I think of some of the people who were involved in the Associated Press, the Bismarck Tribune, our bureau, the Herald, the Minot News, the Minot Daily News had people coming down here to cover the Capitol, cover the legislature. I think that not only are there fewer people covering state government and the larger local governments, the depth of their experience in government, the understanding of how government works, where the bodies are buried, as they say, there are fewer and fewer of those people. Dave is one of the last standing, and he knows as much about what goes on in the Capitol and state government than any working reporter today. There just aren't enough Daves doing the job across the state.
I'd warn you of one other trend in North Dakota. There is a serious effort going on to sharply curtail the rights of initiative and referendum.
That's right, yes.
In the state. Those were hard won and took quite a lot of courage on the part of people who brought them to us. So I think we need to be alert to what the political system is doing that makes it more difficult for individual citizens or even citizens en masse to have, you know, an effective involvement in government. I think the change from 2-year to 4-year terms for members of the House of Representatives was a catastrophic mistake. Just as the and for this reason, it takes away the people's right to change their minds. So that you know you can't sweep the bums out at any one point anymore. The other big mistake that was made, and this is a mistake that the people made because they approved this in a constitutional amendment, was changing the terms on the Board of Higher Education from 7 years, one term only. I believe in all the history of the board, there's only been one person who was reappointed to a 7-year term. And that person was ill and wasn't expected to live very long. So we went from 7 years, one term, to 2 terms, reappointment possible. And frankly, I've been around a long time, quality of the Board of Higher Education has declined. And the decline, I think, is linked to that, you know, it seems like an innocent and maybe even subtle change, but those things do matter. And I think that if we're interested in good government, we need to be alert to those kinds of manipulations in the structure of the government that we've built, and that we've made work in the state.
I have one quick inside baseball thing that I've seen a little bit of erosion. When I first started covering the legislature, party caucuses were held on site at the Capitol. Now they not only can hold what they call, quote, social caucuses, end quote, off-site, but often those are where a lot of discussion happens. They may not take votes, but they get a sense of the caucus. And we're not allowed to be there. Sometimes we show up and sometimes we're asked to leave, but they won't tell you where it is. Often they come back the next day and things have changed.
You're listening to a media panel discussion on good governance that was recorded last April. We'll have more after this break.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. When people think of literacy, they think of simple reading and writing. But it's a lot more complicated than that. It involves culture, power, and the opinion of others. On Why Radio, we'll discuss what literacy means, the way it plays into stereotypes, and how different institutions choose their own definitions. So join me and my guest Kim Donahauer for What is Literacy? On the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today we are revisiting a conversation from April of last year about good government and the role journalists play in holding government officials accountable to the people who elected them. On the panel, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, Cecile Werman with Journal Publishing, Amy Dalrymple with the Bismarck Tribune, Jack Zaleski with the Forum, and Mike Jacobs with the Grand Forks Herald. Our Doug Hamilton moderated the conversation. In the time since this conversation was recorded, the people of North Dakota voted to approve Measure 1, establishing an ethics commission. We pick up the conversation with Cecile.
There's been a couple of instances in my reporting career that I can think of on a local basis where a sheriff or a president of an authority, say an airport authority, was engaged in some illegal activity and actually under indictment. And you know, when that happens, when somebody does do something wrong in North Dakota, it's not easy to get them out of office. It's really quite difficult. And in one of the cases, I remember the governor had some mechanism to go ahead and deal with it, and for whatever reason chose not to. So when somebody does do something wrong, I think we definitely could have some improvement in how we handle that.
Would it be unethical for the county commission chairman to pave the road to his farm? Not saying it's ever happened, of course.
But you point out, that's a good point, though. I mean, we have to wear so many hats in small communities. The ability to remain without any conflict of interest is pretty tough, but again, getting back to what Thomas Jefferson said about, you know, always doing the best things that you can and not just trusting yourself and power. I mean, you really have to weigh carefully whether it's for the good of all and not just for the good of you, and solicit input from other people in the community.
North Dakota, with, you know, 750,000 population, We talk about the government as the legislature and the executive offices here in Bismarck, but the state has boards after boards after boards after boards, water boards, township boards, county boards, all kinds of variations, professional boards. So the government here is wide and actually pretty deep. Chances are you know somebody who performs a public function.
Close to impossible not to.
Yeah.
One of the things that Lloyd Amdahl did in his political science classes at UND was have us calculate how many public boards there were. We got to pick a county, and in Nelson County, which is the one that I picked because it was close by, Grand Forks, and something like out of a population of 1,500 people, maybe 2,000, something like 300-400 of them had actual public positions. And across the state, I think Lloyd always said, and I think this is true still, North Dakota has the highest percentage of its population involved in public boards of one kind or another than any other state. One of my favorite legislative stories was the fight in the 1977 session, not over the coal severance tax, but between the cosmetologists and the people who use depilating creams to manage unsightly body hair. There are two separate boards.
Right.
Yeah, that was a hairy one, Mike. So. Good government requires the sunshine we talked about, whether it's in the House chamber or in what we do as journalists, or supposed to do as journalists. When we don't have as many people carrying the light, government tends to do bad things. Not because they want to, because it's the nature of the beast. You know, not because they're evil, but it's easier to do the people's work behind closed doors than it is with the people watching. We are supposed to be the watchers. If there are fewer and fewer watchers who know what to look for, then government tends to do bad things. And it's not partisan. It's the nature of, God, I have to deal with this character from my hometown. Let's close the door. You know, and so I think that happens. So again, I come back to the fact that some of the oversight that the press is supposed to provide and did provide for generations here, and I believe, and I don't think this is looking through older eyes here. I think it's an actual, it can be measured, that fewer lights are being shown into the halls of government, into the boards, into the various boards, into the school boards. You look at a city like Fargo, which has grown and has more and more and more and more going on all the time. Several school boards, several art boards, several city governments. If you don't have the resources to look at what they're doing, to report about what they're doing, tell the people what they're doing, then they don't know what they're doing. That tends to generate bad habits among people who hold office.
There's a new threat on the horizon, too. I just had my first experience with learning of a small town city council that was making decisions by text. So how do you begin to police that?
Don't they have to send it to everybody in town then?
Well,
sort of like a red alert.
But that's going to happen. That's going to happen. That's going to be, and it's very convenient. I mean, these people are working. They're busy. Being on a city council in a small town is a secondary job that doesn't pay well, and they got to get stuff done. But if they're going to do that a lot, I mean, that just is ripe for abuse.
Well, I used to work in higher education, and occasionally we'd get these information requests from the forum, occasionally, as a matter of fact. And we learned that you do not put anything in an email that you would not want everybody to see.
Well, Dean Brashani hasn't learned that lesson.
I was going to say the Board of Higher Education has several examples of that.
So we actually communicate a little differently than we used to. And the way information gets to reporters sometimes gets there differently than it used to. So what's happened to the actual meat and potatoes of what it is we do? Facts.
There is the $64 million question, I believe. In my estimation, what I have seen is that sometimes social media things are broadcast or written about without doing the due diligence of picking up the phone and checking the fact. Case in point, I happened to tune on one of our local AM radio stations that used to have a pretty good reputation for news. And he came on and said, "We have reports of shots being fired at Legacy High School. 3 students are dead, 17 are injured." And I thought, now what? So I called Bismarck Schools, got a hold of Renee Walker, and Renee said, "They're reporting what?" It was totally a social media hoax, and you have people who are taking things off social media, A, not attributing it to social media, B, saying, "We have learned." And I think that that could be, you know, some of the ethical lapses that we're seeing in our business. There's an old saw that everybody on this panel has heard: if your mother says she loves you, check her sources.
We've got only a minute or so left.
Well, I'm the old guy. In a panel like this in Grand Forks, I called myself a contextualizer, and that's what I like to think I do. But I would just remind you, each and every one of you, that good government is your responsibility, and getting good information is your responsibility. The fancy word for this is curate. You need to curate your own sources. You need to be comfortable with the sources that you're looking at. If you're a seriously interested in public affairs, you ought to be looking at more than one point of view, and you ought to be making up your own mind. You ought not be calling up the newspaper to complain that they're not covering something. You ought not be blaming, you know, fake news on anybody else. I mean, you need to be in a position to make your own judgments about the information that you're consuming.
We'll end it with that. Amy Dalrymple, Mike Jacobs, Jack Zaleski, Dave Thompson, and Cecile Werman, thank you very much. And thank you.
And that conversation was recorded in April during the Good Government Summit, supported by ThinkND, the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, Humanities North Dakota, and the Bush Foundation. Coming up next, Jukebox Dreamin'. But now, it's time for the news. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Tax season is approaching, and some North Dakotans qualify for free assistance preparing their federal income returns. The Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, or VITA program, offers tax aid to people who generally make $54,000 a year or less, have disabilities, or limited English-speaking skills. Rhonda Belgard-Baker with Legal Services of North Dakota, which is partnering with the IRS to provide the program, says people seek assistance for many reasons. She says for some clients it's their first time filing and others owe a debt and are afraid to file.
We come across many different examples of why perhaps they haven't filed or why they need to file. So that's one thing that we work really hard on, is to educate them and to make sure that the IRS isn't scary.
Belgard-Baker says her organization's goal isn't just to help with returns, but to educate people on their taxes. VITA clinics are certified through the IRS each year on tax laws and changes to the tax code. She also notes Legal Services is looking for volunteers and says folks make a difference in someone's life if they help out.
We're educating you. You will get trained like we do and get certified, but you're also helping build a better community and volunteering and being able to provide such a wonderful service.
Belgard-Baker says Legal Services is providing VITA sites on Native American reservations in the state where there's a big need for free aid. VITA locations, as well as tax counseling for the elderly program sites generally operated by AARP, can be found on the IRS's website. A Minot lawmaker has introduced a bill to allow cigar smoking in designated cigar bars. Republican Senator Ole Larson says his bill would only permit cigars, and the bar has to generate 10% or more of its gross annual income from the sale of cigars. Larson says a constituent asked him to introduce the measure.
I've been around the country and I've been to VIP bars where they have smoking bars, and it's a whole different type of atmosphere, and smoking cigars is legal. There's not a huge amount of people that rush to do it. It's not smoking cigarettes it's not opening that up at all.
The measure defines cigar as a roll of tobacco with a wrapper or cover consisting only of tobacco and is sold without a filter. And a Bismarck legislator has introduced a measure to allow sports betting in North Dakota. This follows a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in a New Jersey case, which has allowed every state to offer sports betting. Republican Representative Jason Doctor says under his bill, charities would be allowed to run their wagering. He says the charities would likely work with a third-party vendor to set up kiosks and phone apps.
People are already doing it online, let's just be honest. And so my bill just allows for people to play in the state of North Dakota and help out the local charities as an alternative. Because people are already going online and betting through Vegas. Now this gives you an opportunity to do it through charitable gaming.
Doctor says his bill would allow betting on professional and college sports. He says there is another bill with a different sponsor that would limit it to professional sports. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that music you are hearing here on Main Street is off the new album Jukebox Dreaming by Tim Sparks and James Buckley, both of whom join me by phone because there is going to be a show coming up here. They will be performing in Detroit Lakes on Saturday and in Moorhead at Junkyard Brewing on Sunday. Tim and James, thank you for joining me today.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
I want to know how you picked the songs on this album, because we have covers here from Paul Simon and the Beatles and Soundgarden, and then we have originals. So how did you pick what songs you wanted on this album, Tim?
I started out playing with James about 3 years ago, and we played in the Twin Cities, and we started out playing a pretty straight-ahead jazz repertoire, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, and gradually begin to morph into a repertoire that is represented in this collection of songs we recorded, and we just picked out our favorite ones that seem to have the most interesting quality in terms of their arrangements and bringing something different to the table about the arrangements, although we play them in a jazz sensibility and deconstructing them and playing them in a jazz style.
Well, when you talk about your favorites, we are talking about two performers here. So, Tim, you have been the national finger-picking champion. You made your name playing Tchaikovsky. You're trained in the style of classical guitar, sort of the Andre Segovia style. You've played a lot of huge names like Lennon and McCartney. You're into avant-garde jazz with John Zorn, James Buckley. You have performed at Coachella. You're Grammy nominated. You've played First Avenue. You've been on The Late Show performing with Lizzo. You've been on a European tour. You're on Bon Iver's new album. Your favorites seem to span an enormous selection of music.
Well, you know, That's one reason why this album is very eclectic. It reflects our sensibility. There's one word that's often used for it, which is called postmodern. It's a term that's just another way of saying eclectic. But we see a common thread of feeling and soulfulness in all these different genres. And one thing we've tried to do in this collection of tunes is kind of link things that are somewhat disparate when you consider, you know, country tunes with R&B tunes or Soundgarden, and we're pretty happy with the way it all comes together, and also with the two original songs that we wrote that ended up being on this collection.
Yeah, I want to know that golden thread that you're weaving between, for example, Merle Haggard. You're performing Mama Tried on this album, and then you've got Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun. I hear those songs, and I hear two very different songs. You two listen to those songs, and James, I'll put this one to you. What do you hear in common between those songs?
Melody, of course. These songs are both driven by really strong melodies that, to the regular layman ear, they still recognize it's a song, and they can kind of follow along with it. I think we're drawn to that as well.
Yeah. How do you two describe the conversation style that you have when you're playing with each other?
Well, since, you know, the bass is a single-note instrument most of the time versus the guitar, which is more of a polyphonic chordal instrument, especially when Tim's playing, there's a lot of counterpoint going on. I think we both take advantage of that in communicating, kind of juggling around the melody, taking turns with it, call and response, things like that, which really, for me, brings the group into another light that, you know, a lot of the bands that I've played in don't necessarily get a chance to explore, which is one of my favorite parts about the group.
You know, in conversation with words between people, there's lots of room for miscommunication. What are miscommunications in music, at least with Tim Sparks and James Buckley? Do you guys have those?
There's been a few times when I haven't showed up at the gig I was supposed to be at, if that's what you mean. But actually,
<Not quite. laughs>
you know, a lot of that happens in the course of playing. And all these songs were worked out playing on a kind of a regular basis at different gigs around the Twin Cities and organically took shape. And a lot of that dialogue is in the context of playing. And I think I like the quality that there is a dialogue that you can hear in the recordings.
There's also a perspective thing, too. We see it as not as a miscommunication or a disagreement, but just two different paths. And a lot of the times, you know, we'll enjoy the fact that there's two things going on rather than, like, think of it as, like, something that went wrong.
That's a healthy perspective, yeah.
Cool.
Well, we should stop teasing our listeners and give them something here. Let's play the title track on this. The song is called Jukebox Dreaming.
Thank you.
was the song Jukebox, streaming the title track off the new album from musicians Tim Sparks and James Buckley, who will be performing Saturday at the Lodge in Detroit Lakes and Sunday in Moorhead at Junkyard Brewing. What's your process for writing a song?
Well, in the case of these songs, James came up with a theme and showed it to me, and then I took it and slept on it for a while, and then I kind of added some harmony and kind of tweaked it a bit, and once we were both happy with it, we decided that's what the song would be.
James, is that your normal process?
I would say so. I think it's a pretty standard, like, George and I or Gershwin kind of zone, you know, where here's a melody, here's a basic counterpoint harmony that, like, moves with the melody. And, you know, Tim would sometimes simplify it. He would sometimes add a ton of stuff. And then the next time we get together, less is there. Or I would actually play a different note than he was asking me to, because it would just where my ears would lead, and he would like that. Then two gigs later, we wouldn't be there anymore. You know, it's this recording didn't take too much time. I think it was an afternoon or something that we just kind of went in and gave you what we had that day. You know, it was that version of that song that day.
Okay. Is the writing process substantially different from when you are reinterpreting a song? Like, you have Merle Haggard on here, you have Lennon and McCartney, you have Paul Simon.
I think that process is very similar, because from my perspective, because you're taking the melody, it's like a coloring book, you know, the melody is the outline, and then you're kind of trying to dress it up with different colors than might normally be associated with the classic version of the song. And that's, I think, what makes it interesting for listeners. They already know the tune, and then you can surprise them with suddenly putting that tune in a different kind of context with the way you color it with the harmony.
Is your brain, like, you are able to just hear a new version of the song? I've got one of those brains who, you know, I hear that original version, and then that's just kind of the end all and be all of that song.
Well, that's the roadmap of the song, and that's what makes jazz great. Or that's the way it can work, is because everyone knows the roadmap, and then the jazz musician can take the roadmap and use that as a point of departure. And then he can take his audience with him to some really new places by altering the roadmap with little detours, so to speak.
We've mentioned some of your influences, and especially that they are very wide-ranging. But then there's also this influence that comes to musicians often from a sense of place. And Tim, you grew up in North Carolina. You've been in Minnesota for a long time. Just, I want to go through the sense of place that comes from music. What does the music of North Carolina say to you, and the music of Minnesota, and just blending those together?
Well, you know, the roots of country and blues and gospel are things I was deeply imbued with growing up in North Carolina. And that tune by Floyd Kramer, Last Day, you know, that's really an iconic kind of roadhouse song. And I guess in Minnesota, it's where I kind of flowered in terms of coming into contact with experimental music and different jazz players. And, you know, in Minnesota, people, it's almost like being in Europe sometimes. There's an openness people have to cultural things here.
James, you know, I'm wondering, for being on tour, being a touring musician, and you have been called the hardest working musician in the Twin Cities, and just a Google search of your name, and you get this huge list of performances that you have done. And I'm thinking, okay, so this Sunday's show, you're playing at a Junkyard. It's a small brewery. It's a great brewery. It's my favorite in town, but it's a small venue. And then, you know, you've played on the Colbert Show with Lizzo, and you've played Coachella.
I was actually just in town playing Seven Nights at the Fargo Theater with the Blenders as well, another group I play with.
Yeah. Do you play these gigs very differently, or are you just James Buckley all the time?
you know, a little of both. I honestly, you know, I like to serve the song, whatever it is, whoever I'm playing it with. You know, it's not a bass player thing. It's a musician thing, I think, more than anything. I really want to add to what's being presented, you know, as a song, rather than, you know, try to make it about me necessarily. Mm-hmm. That being said, I do love virtuosity in music too. So I do try to bring a little, what little I have of that to the table whenever I can. But yeah, it's definitely, as a bass player, there is a certain, you know, thing you need to do for a song, in my opinion. But as a bass player, I definitely feel like I've carved out a little something that I can call me, you know? So I hope that answers the question a little bit.
Let's hear another sample. We want to hear the song Mama Tried. This is a cover of Merle Haggard's classic. Listening to Tim Sparks and James Buckley perform the song Mama Tried, originally by Merle Haggard. It's off the new album Jukebox Dreaming. This is a fun song.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. Thank you.
You know, this to me is when I hear finger picking, like I kind of go to that sort of, you know, old country kind of sound. But really, finger picking can be played in lots of different styles. And I wonder, Tim, I mean, is finger picking, no matter if you're playing, you know, classical sort of Andre Segovia style, or if you're playing the country or the blues, is there a difference in the way that you finger pick?
Yeah, I think so, because you're pulling out different sounds, although the principle of orchestrally playing your guitar with your hands, your fingers, is very similar in terms of how you have to be able to have your right hand and left hand be independent of each other. You know, there's a certain skills you need to learn, and I was learning those being self-taught, playing blues and country music, and then I was able to go in high school and study classical guitar, and then that totally evolved that idea for me, and I've kind of stuck to that ever since. I always come back to trying to play cool things, you know, on the guitar, like a little orchestra, you know?
Mm-hmm. How do you keep your fingernails in the right condition? Because I got to imagine you got to keep those pretty exact.
Yeah, you got to have a little kid, a little manicure kid, and keep them dialed in and be able to repair them kind of constantly. They're always breaking and needing to be upgraded.
Do you take some hair, skin, and nail vitamins, maybe?
Yep. Go to Walgreens and get some glue.
Do you like teaching? You've been on the faculty at the University of Morris. You have online guitar lessons. What do you like about teaching?
I loved my time at Morris, and I loved the kids that were there, and a number of them I still are in touch with, and they're really good musicians, like Thomas Nordland, who's in the Twin Cities now and doing quite a lot of really great work. I've done some really good series for True Fire, and it's an element that I enjoy, explaining, you know, the music, and you want the music to continue in other people's hands, so it's a meaningful thing to do for me.
Music in other people's hands. James, who are you watching as an up-and-comer?
Up-and-comer?
Yeah, who do you like?
Well, who am I interested in?
Yeah.
Let's see here. I love Anderson .Paak. I wouldn't call him an up-and-comer. He's world famous, but he's, you know, it's wildly. I'm really into like pop music, R&B. I spend a lot of my time listening to music like that to like grab new things from and kind of try to relate to the world around me, because a lot of the people I know don't know who Red Garland is. But Red Garland's my favorite piano player. You know, he played with Miles Davis in the 50s, and a lot of my friends don't never even heard of him, you know. So I listen to a lot of modern pop music to kind of just bring reel in my 25, 30 years of just listening to old music and just considering my voice rather than like music being this thing that I put on to it, you know, to have sound while I do homework. You know, I've never been that person. If music's on, it's what I'm doing, you know. So I don't know who else to mention. I love the band Low. They've been around for 30 years. They're good friends and extremely influential and talented people that have changed my musical life several different times over. The Minneapolis music community is incredible. There's too many to mention, but just the individual efforts from people like Totally Gross National Product is a local label here that put on a lot of really great stuff. This organization called People that Justin Vernon and Bon Iver, and that whole camp of people. I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, so I had relationships with these people like 25 years ago when we were all in school together. But to watch all these people grow into, not only grow into their own, but make their own a giant community effort that involves several other communities, parts of the world, It's just been extremely motivating more than anything to like keep going and like, oh, look at all the stuff you can do, you know? I like that. I like doing this stuff more than the stuff I've been doing. Maybe I'll just do this stuff now, you know? And I feel like every year there's more stuff to check out. And it's a lot of my friends and it's a lot of their friends. And communities grow and expand in the weirdest ways, you know? It's like you'll go 2 years and not meet anybody new and then suddenly you'll meet 1,000 people in a year, you know, somehow. Or it's more, 5 to 15,000 by like performing and touring. It's a really cool thing, like performing for a living and playing music as like your artistic statement. You know what I mean? Like there's so much that comes along with that involving like community and the people in the world, you know? And I definitely lose track of that time and time again, but it's really good for me to remind myself of that. And putting out records with friends definitely is a time that brings all that to the forefront in my head and makes me remember, you know, like that I'm a part of this giant thing, you know.
We've been visiting with guitarist Tim Sparks and bass player James Buckley, and they will be performing on Saturday in Detroit Lakes at the Lodge and on Sunday in Moorhead at Junkyard Brewing from 4 to 6 p.m., selling their new album, Jukebox Dreaming. Tim and James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate your support.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by financial associate Kyle Deberton with Thrivent Financial in Bismarck, helping members be wise with money and live generously. Details and information on how to reach Kyle can be found online at thrivent.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 11th. In the 1870s, Alexander Graham Bell and Elisha Gray both invented devices capable of transmitting speech. Bell rushed his invention to the patent office first, and today his name is synonymous with the telephone. By 1880, a phone line connected Boston to Somerville, Massachusetts. By the end of 1880, there were 47,900 phones in the United States. The first payphone was installed in 1889. Service between New York and Chicago began in 1892, and in 1894, New York was connected to Boston. The first telephones were used primarily for business, but all did not go smoothly. Phone users often had difficulty making the adjustment from communicating by telegraph. On this date in 1901, an article in the Devil's Lake Interocean reminded readers that following simple rules of telephone etiquette would make communication much easier and more effective. The article was written by Angus Hibbard, the general manager of the Chicago Telephone Company. He shared the experience he gained by advising businessmen. Hibbard noted that for a busy man, the phone offered a means of conserving money, time, and energy, but it had to be used correctly. Hibbard's first bit of advice was to speak clearly into the mouthpiece with the mouth close to the instrument. He said that no one would do business with someone who insisted on carrying on a conversation with his back turned, but many of those he advised kept a foot away from the mouthpiece or even turned away from it, then wondered why the other party couldn't hear them. Another problem in communication was a loss of concentration on the task at hand. Because the other person in the conversation was not in the same room, it was easy to forget that the conversation was with a real person and not an inanimate object. Hibbard noted that telephone calls, especially long distance, were an expense. They should be used efficiently and attentively. There's no way Mr. Hibbard could have imagined that people would one day carry phones with them wherever they go. But his 1901 advice is still not bad. He said if users handled the phone properly and used it efficiently, it will do its duty. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Trump administration says the U.S. needs a wall to stop terrorists from crossing the border from Mexico. But how accurate are their explanations?
The most vulnerable point of entry that we have into this country is our southern border, and we have to protect it. And the more and more that individuals...
They're not coming across the southern border, Sarah. They're coming and they're being stopped at airports.
They're coming a number of ways.
Fact-checking border claims. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, this time of year, we start thinking new year, new you. Well, how about just a new perspective on the existing you? We visit with best-selling author Janine Roth about her latest book, This Messy, Magnificent Life, a field guide to mind, body, and soul. It offers a new, if slightly unconventional, look at self-criticism. Also tomorrow, Race, Are We So Different? A traveling exhibit from the Science Museum of Minnesota examines that question. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.